Thanks, Chong, for the invitation and also for the very warm introduction. It's great to see all of you, and I hope at some point could visit the perimeter and also the Toronto region in person. So let me begin by acknowledging my collaborators. There are many of them. It's probably one of our papers with the largest number of co-authors, which is actually two papers. So I want to especially highlight Joseph Sullivan, who's my graduate student and is on job market right now. And also Xiu Qima, who's a PhD student in Caltech working with Xie Chen. All right, so since this is a quantum matter seminar, I think it's fitting to start from a little map, a little kind of landscape, map of landscape of what we know about quantum matter. This is actually inspired by a nice talk by Liu Jin last year. And you don't need to read into all these different lines, the different items that I write here. But the two items that are in red will be somewhat featured in this talk. Okay. And broadly speaking, we divide this quantum matter at zero temperature into two classes, gapped and gapless. And gapped ones are rightfully better understood because of much simpler dynamics. And we know that a lot of them, maybe with the exception of these fractal phases, can be described by topological quantum field theories. And by the way, please feel free to interrupt with any questions or comments. A lot of them can be described by topological quantum field theories at low energy. And perhaps the simplest topological quantum field theory, that's a somewhat subjective thing, but one of the most well-known topological quantum field theory is a transignment theory in 2 plus 1D. So let me very briefly review what the U1 transignment theory is in 2 plus 1, although I'm pretty sure that most of you know this pretty well. So a transignment theory takes the following form. So you have a U1 gauge field, little a, and the action is simply the transignments term of this A with a quantized coefficient K. And it is well known that this U1 level K transignments theory describes the 1 over K, for example, Laughlin state in a fractional quantum Hall system at low energy. Okay. And we can couple this transignments gauge theory to matter just by doing the standard minimal coupling. And the physics of the transignments term can be understood from just writing down the equation of motion. And we see that what it really does is to attach magnetic flux to electric charge. So the charge density is K over 2 pi times magnetic flux density. Okay. And because of this flux attachment, the gauge charges become anions, so have non-trivial braiding of self and mutual braiding statistics. So this is sort of the defining feature of the transignment theory. And the same thing can be phrased in terms of the Wilson loop observables. We can write down at low energy, the only observables of this topological quantum field theory are the Wilson loops. And if the Wilson loops are linked with each other, then you get a non-trivial value for the expectation value, which is essentially the braiding statistics between two particles. So this is a single component transignment theory, and this theory can be generalized to the case of multiple U1 gauge fields. This is known as a multi-component transignment theory. So in that case, the most general action that one can write down takes the following form. So you have now A of I, where I labels the different components of the gauge fields. Not the space-time component, just different flavors of the gauge fields. And now the coefficient is generalized into a K matrix, where K is an integer symmetric matrix that encodes both the various kinds of transignments interactions between the gauge fields. So this multi-component transignment series now describe, for example, the Jane states or multi-layer fractional quantum Hall states. And similarly, we can couple this multi-component transignment theory to matter. And now matter also comes in different flavors corresponding to, you know, different kinds of gauge charges. And there's a similar flex attachment, you know, following from the equation of motion. Okay. All right. And it turns out that, you know, this multi-component transignment series describe all abelian topological faces in 2+1 dimension. This is the most general that one can write down. Okay, so, you know, the transignment series almost by definition live in 2+1 dimensions because, you know, this is a dimension given by the transignment's term ADA. Okay. We'd like to see whether we can use this, you know, very well-known topological quantum field theory to describe, to do something in 3+1D. So one natural way to generalize it to 3+1D is to imagine that you have infinite many layers. Each layer harbors a transignment's gauge field, and their, you know, layers are coupled by some kind of transignment's term. Okay? So this is what we call infinite component transignment theory. Okay? So to be more concrete, let's imagine that you have this infinite number of layers. I mean, they don't have to be actually physically distinct layers, but each layer has transignment's gauge field A of I. So A of I is somewhat localized in the ice layer, okay? And we write down this action, which contains, the transignment term between the gauge fields in the same layer, that's M ADA term. And then now we also include the term that couples neighboring layers, which is the second term here is with a coefficient N, so AI and DAI plus one, okay? So this is gonna be the theory that I'm going to study. And we'll see that actually describes a rather rich physics of, you know, different kinds of 3+1 quantum faces. All right, and this theory can also be just, you know, compactly written as a K-matrix, but now it's an infinite dimensional K-matrix with the diagonal elements all being equal to M, and you have like the nearest neighbor off diagonal being N. So the theory was actually studied in the context of, you know, layered three-dimensional quantum Hall systems back in the early 90s and also around 2000. And I'll come back to the potential physical realizations in that kind of system a bit later in the talk. All right, so let's for now work with this effective field theory that involves an infinite number of U1 gauge fields. 2+1 U1 gauge fields. So these A's are really 2+1 fields, has time and two spatial components. And this I will represent different locations in the Z direction, the different layers. Okay. All right. So to understand what's going on, let's first start from the simplest case where we just have the diagonal transignment's term. So turn off the off-diagonal ones, set N to zero. In that case, it's simply a stack of one over M Laughlin states. So each of these terms describes the Laughlin state. Then, you know, we just get a stack of one over M Laughlin states. Even this, you know, very silly looking state is already kind of interesting if you think about it from the point of view of topological quantum field theory, because it's a rather unconventional one compared to other kind of topological quantum field theories we know in 3+1D. And in some sense, it's more like a crystal-like state compared to the liquid-like state of the usual topological quantum field series. So, for example, if you look at ground state degeneracy of this, you know, stack of Laughlin states, well, the number of ground states scales exponentially with the number of layers in the z direction. So that's already very different from all the other topological quantum field theories in 3+1, where you have a constant ground state degeneracy on the torus, or at least, you know, bounded from above. And just, you know, very trivially, excitations or the quadratic particles only move in the planes because we just have this stack of 2+1 Laughlin states. So there's an emergent restriction on how the excitations can move in this system. we call these planons because they move in plane. Okay. So this, of course, is just a very simple state where you have a stack of 2+1 topological order states in three dimensions that give rise to all these somewhat unconventional features. But we can, starting from this setup, we can make it more interesting by turning on couplings between the various layers. So of course, the mutual transimence term is one way to make it more interesting and less like just a trivial stack of 2+1 systems. But let me first say a few more words about other ways to sort of make it more three-dimensional. Okay. So one thing we can do is to take actually intersecting stacks of two-dimensional topological order states. Instead of just one stack, you can take two stacks in different directions. And now these different stacks intersect along one-dimensional interfaces. And we can choose different kinds of boundary conditions on this interface by doing certain kind of anion condensations or boson condensations. And turns out that this setup can generate many known Fredkov models. Okay. So just to give one example of this kind, let's consider a slightly different system, although along the same line. So let's consider a stack of Z4 toric codes. So each of these line represents a two-dimensional Z4 toric code model. And beginning from this stack, we turn on interactions between the neighboring layers so that this particular combination of anions from the neighboring layers condense. Okay. So E is a Z4 gauge charge and M is a Z4 magnetic flux. And we condense this combination of E square and M square. Okay. And we do that for all pairs of adjacent layers. Okay. So once you do that, we arrive at a new three-dimensional gapped phase, turns out. And this gapped phase can be described, again, using infinite component transimence theory, although it's not the one that I wrote down a couple slides ago, but it also involves an infinite number of gauge fields with couplings between not just nearest neighbor, but also next nearest neighbor layers. Okay. But nevertheless, it falls into this kind of description. It turns out that this particular example has an interesting feature that is the word foliated in this title. So you start from, say, the gauge, this theory, the infinite component transimence theory with n layers. We can perform some basis transformation to cleave one layer out of the n layer. So if you have this theory with n layers, we can do some transformation to separate a corner of A by A gauge fields, A by A K matrix, the red corner here, and the remaining n minus A dimensional K matrix takes essentially the same form. Okay. So you can do this repeatedly and sort of just separate out the layer by layer, some two-dimensional topological phase. Okay. So it has this very nice structure that that allows you to kind of sort of disentangle this space into two-dimensional stacks of two-dimensional layers. Although this transformation that you use to disentangle this red block, it's local, only acting on a few nearby layers. But if you want to disentangle all of them, you need to mix gauge fields from all layers. Okay. All right, this is a kind of infinite component transimence you can get in three dimensions, but this is not what I will focus on. So before I move on, let me just make a few more remarks. So it turned out that this is a rather general picture that covers a lot of the Fredkov models that we know. So you start from a three-dimensional topological quantum field theory, and putting various kinds of two-dimensional layers, and here I call it defect network, and they can intersect and form maybe some complicated geometric structure. Okay. And if these defects are invertible, meaning that you insert invertible states, then you get you can describe symmetry protected phase or symmetry enriched topological phase in three dimensions. Or if you put in non-invertible means topological, actually topological order layers, then you get fractal models. And it turns out that all exactly solvable fractal models, you know, people have studied so far as I know, can be constructed this way. Here, exactly solvable just means the models is written in terms of some commuting projectors. All right, so let me pause and see whether there are any questions.
Quick question. Yeah. For this statement, does that include the Haas code?
Yes, that includes Haas code. It takes some inspiration to construct this defect network.
So the defects will be fractals or are they still just regular 1-3 dimensional stuff?
They're still a regular sort of a cubic structure. I don't think anything fractal is involved.
I see.
But you need to very carefully choose, you know, what to do on the interfaces, on the one-dimensional interface, and etc.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. So it's very complicated. So to construct Haas model this way, it's very complicated. A simpler construction for the B model was given in this paper by Davis and et al.
Thanks.
Yes. All right. So let's now come back to the infinite component transignment theory. Okay. So the first thing is to figure out the nth spectrum of this theory. So naively, one will think that the theory is gapped because all transignment theories in two dimensions are gapped. But there's actually a little surprise when you take this infinite component three-dimensional generalization, that is to reveal the nth spectrum, to reveal the kind of a generic dynamics. We actually add Maxwell terms to a theory to avoid very fine tuning limits. And once we just add the simplest Maxwell term, which is F squared for each layer. So it's an interlayer kind of Maxwell term. And you can just go and solve the Gaussian spectrum of the theory. And the result is the following. So very generally for any K matrix, actually the spectrum looks like this. So it's kx squared plus ky squared, that's just the propagating mode in the xy plane, and plus the mass kind of term, which is k squared, kq squared, where q labels different eigenvalues of the k matrix. If you diagonalize it, you get different eigenvalues, and these are the masses of these different photon modes. So because of kind of infinite component transignment theory that we are interested in are translation invariant in the z direction, so we can just take lattice momentum. And the lattice moment and the kq takes this very simple form. It's n plus 2n times cosine of q. So q is the z momentum. So now whether the photon spectrum is gapped or gapless, depending on the choice of these two parameters. So if m is greater than 2n, absolute value of m is greater than 2 times absolute value of n, then the photons are all gapped. Otherwise, the photons are actually gapless for some momentum. So the gap closes for some choice of Q. Okay. All right. And also the theory also contains gauge charges, which stay gapped, even though the photons are gapless. All right. So this is already quite different from what we usually think of transignment theories in 2+1. So usually they are all gapped, but here, because of the infinite number of components, you can actually get gapless theories. So let me first start from the gapped ones. And the gapped ones can be analyzed just using the usual machinery of U1 transignment theory, all the usual results, all formulas to calculate grading statistics and ground state degeneracies can be applied to this infinite component transignment theory. Of course, to actually do it, we would take, say, a finite number of layers in the z direction, okay, and then maybe take the thermodynamic limit of the number of layers going to infinity. So assuming that number of layers is just a big N, then we can find, for example, the ground state degeneracy of this model grows exponentially with N. That's not surprising since we start from it looks like a stack of 2+1 topological order states. But now the base of this exponential growth is not integer. In general, it's irrational number. Okay, so you cannot really think of it as some kind of stacks of two-dimensional states. Otherwise, in that case, you would get some integer to the nth power. Okay, and we can also calculate breeding statistics between quadriparticles. So, at least formally, we can associate quadriparticles to different layers indexed by this layer index I and J. And we can calculate the breeding between, say, the quadriparticle in the ice layer, a unit gauge charge in ice layer, and one from the J's layer. And we get the breeding statistics in limit of infinite number of layers. So this is already taking the infinite number of layers limit. Okay. And again, we get a breeding phase. So this is actually the phase, the breeding phase being an irrational number in general.
So is there any way of intuition, at least for the first line here, for the irrational base for the degeneracy? I mean, or how, or at least in general, how you obtain this kind of result?
Oh, I mean, how? Well, yeah. So
yeah, I know about examples. You know, with these spin models where you can obtain a fractional entropy or degeneracy, but
yeah. So maybe let me clarify this a bit. So it's not the degeneracy, of course, is an integer, cannot be rational.
Yes.
What I mean that the asymptotic growth of the degeneracy follows this pattern. So there's a small piece that make it integer.
I see.
But the dominant term is this one with a irrational base.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So it's just you look at increment basically.
But
so look at it as a basically differential form, right? So I mean, ddn of something is.
What do you mean ddn?
D degeneracy over d capital n.
Oh, d to the n. You mean
yeah.
D this number here.
Right. Maybe not. Okay. Yeah, I can
ask. Actually, later.
Yeah.
All right. So the breeding between the layers, let me come back to breeding between layers is e to I of theta. One feature that I want to highlight is that this is not equal to one for any value of I and j. It's always some non-zero value, no matter how far apart these two layers are separated. You always get a non-trivial breeding between quadriparticles that are supposedly localized in on these layers. Okay? Although this number indeed decays as the separation becomes larger and larger, goes to zero. So there's still kind of locality, but the breeding's kind of long range. And this is probably the most interesting feature of this model, that you get this long range breeding that is difficult or even impossible to realize using this picture of defect network that I introduced on previous slide. So you can also think about this long range breeding from the point of view of canonical quantization. So if you just follow the standard procedure to quantize this transimon theory, you'll find that the gauge fields themselves do not commute from different layers. The gauge fields from different layers do not commute, no matter how far apart these gauge fields are. Okay. Just because the K inverse is non-zero for any value of I and j. Okay. So what it says is that what this means that these gauge fields are not really strictly local in the z direction. Okay, so we cannot really think of them as like strictly localized in different layers. It's something quite different. It's more like an emergent degree of freedom. So to better understand what's going on, I'll briefly introduce a lattice model that we use to sort of gain some intuition about what's actually the physical nature of these gauge fields. So one way to realize this theory in a somewhat lattice model is to start from a stack of integer quantum Hall states. So they're just all the lowest Landau level integer quantum Hall states with Hall conductance equal to one. Okay. And taking the stack, we couple these integer quantum Hall states to gauge fields. Okay. So the first gauge fields A1 couples to fermions in the first three layers, 1, 2, and 3. And the second gauge fields A2 couples to fermions in the layer 3, 4, and 5. So they kind of overlap on layer 3. And the next one would couple to 5, 6, and 7. So we overlap with the previous one on layer 5, etc. So you can imagine now if you integrate out all the integer quantum Hall matter fermions, you get a diagonal component for the Trans-Simons term for the gauge field A1, A2, because you have three layers, for example, here, and that gives you Hall conductance 3. But you also get Trans-Simons coupling between A1, A2, for example, because they kind of touch on one layer. All right, so this is one way to realize this infinite component Trans-Simons theory by coupling integer quantum Hall states, a stack of integer quantum Hall states, to some kind of planar E1 gauge fields. Okay. Now, we can ask what actually happens if you insert a test charge for, say, the ice gauge field. That supposedly creates a quadratic particle in the ice layer. So to do that, this test charge can be created by just putting in the theory a Wilson line operator of the ice gauge field. However, because of all these integer quantum Hall layers and the Trans-Simons Hall response, this test charge in the ice layer actually induces magnetic fluxes, the gauge fluxes, in all the other layers. And that's exactly given by the inverse of the K matrix. The distribution of these magnetic fluxes are given by the K inverse. So the magnetic fluxes you get decays as you go away from the layer where you inserted the charge, but decay expansion has an exponential tail. And the integer quantum Hall state have to respond to this flux. You insert this flux, the integer quantum Hall states have to somewhat adjust themselves to respond to the flux. So what that means is that although naively we just insert one charge to the ice layer, you have to modify the wave function, the ground state wave function in all the other layers, although the modification sort of dies away as you move away from this ice layer. Okay? And in other words, the anyon string operator, this operator that you use to create and move anyons, they actually have exponential support in the z direction. Okay? It's not really a strictly localized operator. And this exponential support, exponential tail, gives rise to this braiding statistics between far apart layers. So that's the reason that we see this somewhat unconventional braiding statistics. All right, so I want to briefly comment on physical realizations of a possible realization of this state. So another way to realize this effective theory is to basically translate the Trans-Simons terms into fractional quantum Hall wave functions. And if M and N are positive, there's a well-defined prescription to do that. I mean, even for negative ones, but let's stay with the positive M and N. So the interlayer Trans-Simons term just translates into this kind of Laughlin vector. Here, these are the coordinates of the little I electron in the big I layer. So this is just the Laughlin part, the gesture factor for the Laughlin-like state. But because we have this mutual Trans-Simons term between neighboring layers, you also need to include some kind of correlation between neighboring layers. And that's done by adding this Zi minus Zi plus one to the nth power. And then we add a Gaussian factor to make it in the lowest Landau level. Okay. So you can imagine this is at least a reasonable trial wave function for electrons in a kind of layered three-dimensional system, like maybe graphite, subject to some magnetic field. So this wave function was studied back in the 90s by Chu, Join, and McDonald. So what they do is that they constructed a variational phase diagram. So comparing the energy of some of these wave functions, and also with, say, various kinds of Wigner crystals or crystalline charge density wave states in three dimensions. So this is the phase diagram they obtained. The x-axis is the filling, and the y-axis is separation between layers, and can imagine that as the layers get close, the interaction between the layers get stronger, and that will somewhat favor a state which has some correlation between the layers. So here, 0 k0 just means like decoupled 1 over k Laughlin states. And 1 k1 is this k matrix that we have been talking about so far, with diagonal element being k and off-diagonal element being 1. So they only consider n equals 1 case. And they also consider k matrix with, you know, longer range couplings, okay, second nearest neighbor couplings. So, you know, it's probably not entirely crazy to imagine that this physics could possibly arise in some sort of three-dimensional layer system. All right, so that this concludes the first part of the talk about the gapped series. And for the rest, half an hour, I'll switch to gapless series. So before that, let me just pause, see whether there are any questions.
Iman, can I ask for the exponentially decaying mutual statistics? Is there an argument saying that's a general consequence of any theory that emerges out of the local model?
Well, I mean, this theory does emerge from local model,
right? Right. I mean,
you mean that whether the strictly local, strictly short range breeding statistics is a
generic? No. I guess my question is: do you have an argument saying that if it comes from a local model, then the mutual statistics has to decay exponentially?
I think one argument is like this. So, you know, if the excitation is actually localized, then we expect that you can use at least a localized, you know, operator to create this, right? A string operator to create the excitation. So the breeding statistics really comes from the commutation relation between the string operators. Mm-hmm. And if the string operators have a support that decays away from, you know, their location, then any commutation relation would also vanish.
Okay.
I think that's one argument. Although it
makes sense.
Yeah. I cannot exclude the possibility that, you know, to create this excitation, you need a very non-local operator that's not localized anyway, but I don't think, I don't know anything like that.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Yeah. All right. So now I'll turn to gapless series. So just to remind you, whether the series is gapped or gapless depends on this choice of these two integers, m and n. When m is greater than 2n, assuming they are positive, you get the gapped photons, and otherwise the photons are gapless. Okay. And a related fact, just a quick comment, that if you actually take this wave function that I wrote down on the previous slide and set m equals n equals 1, these gentlemen show that this wave function actually describes a charge density wave state. So there's something very different going on when m is smaller than 2n. And when you have gapless excitations, a natural question is whether, you know, this is actually something stable, or, you know, what are the instabilities if not? And because the theory has this, all these transimons terms, you know, you naturally wonder what happens to the topological excitations, you know, what happens to the quadriparticles. So next, first I'll describe another model that, you know, better suits its purpose to realize this series for any value of m and n, which are easier to analyze compared to the lattice gauge theory model that I introduced a few slides ago. And I'll focus on the case where m is actually equal to minus 2n, which I'll argue that describes a compressible state. Okay. All right, so the model that I'll study, well, the model that I'll use to realize this infinite component transimon theory belongs to a class of models called couple wire construction. So the idea for this construction is to start from an array of wires. So this could be done in two dimensions or three dimensions, although most of, you know, the existing constructions are in two dimensions. So you can start from an array of wires, and each wire is just, you know, electron gas or a quantum wire of electrons or of bosons. And we can describe each wire using a Luttinger liquid. Okay. So each wire is a Luttinger liquid, has two conjugate bosonic fields, phi and theta. Now we turn on interactions between neighboring wires, adjacent wires. So the interaction term is depicted here. So this is a somewhat complicated interaction that involves six wires at a time. Then you just make translation copies of this term. Here, the interaction is a cosine term. So it's a kind of backscattering or sine Gordon type terms for the Luttinger liquid, also involves six of them. So instead of reading what the terms, how the term is defined, let me actually give some intuition of what this interaction term actually does. Okay. So the term kind of is made of two parts. The first part is a product of these two kinds of different processes. So the first term, the first part is just a boson hopping between neighboring wires, nearest neighbor wires, along the y direction. So let me actually, I didn't give the coordinate, but the horizontal coordinate is y and the vertical one is z. Okay, so the first part is just a boson hopping between neighboring wires. E to I phi creates a boson. If that was the only term in the interaction, then we simply get a stack of superfluids in the z direction. Now, there's a second part of this physical process that actually hops, in some sense, vortices from one wire to another. So e to the I theta creates a 2 pi phase slip in each wire, and a term like this actually hops a phase slip across wires. And in particular, this phase slip hopping with this phase slip creation operators carries momentum. So e to the I theta carries momentum 2 pi times nu, where nu is the filling of, say, this wire. All right, so now if we put these two types of terms together, so you get a boson hopping between this wire and that wire, and then you also get phase slips hopping between different wires. So let's analyze the symmetry of this interaction. Okay. So first of all, the interaction actually preserves the U1 charge symmetry. So remember that E to the I phi creates a U1 charge and E to the I theta is charge neutral. So it actually conserves the U1 charge in each layer, each Z layer, because it's only hopping between horizontal direction. Okay. Now we can also ask whether the interaction preserves momentum or translation symmetry in the X direction, obviously preserve the translation symmetry in the Y and Z direction. Okay. So the X momentum of these wires is basically given by the winding number of the phi fields, and then you multiply by nu. Okay. And it turns out that this momentum is conserved when m is equal to minus 2m, okay, for any value of nu. So actually it conserves the axial U1 charge of each of these, the total axial U1 charge of all the wires. So what it means is that this Hamiltonian actually preserves the U1 symmetry and the translation symmetry for any value of the filling. Okay. So, of course that's not enough, but by making all these cosine terms relevant or tuning the coefficient to be very large, because all these cosine terms are unfrustrated, you'll get a nice unique ground state. Okay. But that means the state is actually compressible because you can define it for any filling. So you might wonder what's going on, since we just have a bunch of one-dimensional wires and we have this kind of Joseph coupling term between the wires, although it's frustrated by the hopping of vortices. Maybe what we get is just a superfluid state. Okay. So we need to analyze the correlation functions of the various other parameter, various operator in the theory. And what we find is that there is actually no local order parameter in the theory, meaning that if you, for example, calculate the correlation function of these vertex operators, e to the I phi and e to I theta, which are charged either under the global charge U1 or the momentum or the axial U1, you always create gapped excitations. So they are infinitely irrelevant at low energy. So what this suggests is that this is actually a stable gapless space. There's no instability of any kind. However, if we now consider operators that are not necessarily locally supported, then we find an order parameter. So this auto parameter is basically the product of all the boson creation operators at a fixed value of y. So this is y direction, and z is just a string-like operator along the z direction that, you know, penetrates the entire system. And we can calculate, for example, the two-point correlation function of this string-like operator, you know, separated by some distance in the xy plane. And you get this usual sort of result expected for a two-dimensional superfluid. Although now the superfluid density, I mean, if we just read it from the exponent, this density kind of goes off like 1 over n, where n is the number of layers in the z direction. In the limit of infinite number of layers, if you take the limit first, then this correlation function actually goes to 0. Okay. All right, so this is a somewhat weird situation where you don't have any local autoparameter, but there's a non-local string-like autoparameter along the z direction, at least for any finite number of layers.
Okay, so this where the parameter grows with rperp?
No, not with rperp. Rperp is just the location of this operator where you put, where you insert this operator. So the other parameter grows with z, you can say, because it's a product of the boson creation operators.
Yeah, I look at the right hand side and it has rperp in the denominator.
With rperp. Well, this is, so if you fix nz, what it says that this is just long range order, right? When rperp is infinite, this is just a constant. Does that make sense? All right. Okay.
So you have subsystem symmetry here, right?
Yeah, yeah, I do have.
And do you need to protect the gapless phase?
Well, so I don't need to. So I don't need this subsystem symmetry to protect this, because any operator that breaks this subsystem symmetry is actually gapped at low energy. Any local operator. And and also, you can break this subsystem symmetry, but it will emerge at low energy. So I think it's better to think of it, even though in this lattice model it's exact, but one can think of it as just the emergent subsystem symmetry at low energy.
Yeah, so I understand that you don't need subsystem U1, and what about like subsystem Z2 or things like that? You don't need any subsystem symmetry, that's your claim.
Yeah, so as far as I can tell, I don't need any symmetries.
Yeah. Okay, I see.
Right. So, of course, it's hard to exhaust. So there are probably lots of discrete symmetries in the model, but at least from what we have looked at, they don't seem to rely on any subsystem symmetry.
And Meng, just sorry. Go ahead. Sorry.
What's your local operation here? I mean,
what are the local operators?
Local gapless operator. Do you have any such example?
Yeah, yeah. So the density operators are gapped or gapless. For example, the charge density, or the charge density, which is derivative of theta, or the derivative of phi. These are gapped. These are gapless. And these are the photons.
Okay, and they are irrelevant. That's the.
They are not irrelevant. Well, just like the photons, they are gapless, but. They don't cause any instability.
Yeah, they're stable, but they don't change the order.
Right. Because these operators are at least neutral under all the symmetries that we have analyzed, and they just create some smooth variations of the field configuration.
Okay, so that's like a marginal operator, right?
Yeah,
it changes something, but it does not destroy the phase.
In that sense, no. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Right.
Yeah, it's marginal to any order, I would say. So.
I think so. I think so. They're marginal. Yeah. Right. Thanks. Okay. So this is what happens, at least in this lattice model. And now let me also briefly comment on the gapped excitations. Okay. So I'll skip the details, derivations, but what we find is that the theory does support gapped topological excitations, in particular, since we have although a somewhat unusual superfluid order, they come with superfluid vortices. Okay? And these vortices have long-range interactions. This R parallel should really be R perp, sorry. So you have these superfluid vortices, and it turns out that all the gapped excitations, the gapped localized excitations are made out of these superfluid vortices. So we can also create excitations without any vorticity, such as a dipole of the vortices. And we can classify the different types of these non-vortex excitations. It turns out that if you take and find a number of layers, the number is the same as the ground state degeneracy on the torus. So that's kind of what you expect in a topological state. Okay. So I'll skip the discussion on the mobility, but just one comment is that they can move in the plane, but most of them, depending on the value m, but most of them do not have any mobility along the z direction. All right, so this is sort of the phenomenology of this model, right? This is what the low energy excitations look like, et cetera. But now let me make connection with a field theory. So far, it's just a couple wire lattice model. So we can kind of derive, it's not rigorous derivation because we have to make some choice how to introduce the gauge fields, et cetera. But using a couple wire version of the Boson-Vorkutex duality, we can sort of derive the transimons, infinite component transimons description of this model. So, of course, as expected, you get this infinite component transimon theory for this is what the K matrix for a finite number of layers. Of course, the same derivation works for any value of m and n. I just write down one for m equals minus 2n. And depending on boundary condition, you might need to change what happens near the top and bottom of the system. So the theory, we can actually at least argue that it is described by this infinite component transimon series by any value of m and n. All right. So, at least from my own point of view, perhaps the most interesting aspect of this is that it's a compressible state. So just to remind everyone, the compressive state is one that compressibility is non-zero, is positive. And usually, of course, at least in this talk, I'm considering a translation invariant system. Okay? So we can tune the charge density continuously by changing current potential, for example. And there are not that many compressible states we know of in condensed matter systems. And they kind of come in two varieties. Right? You can start from a system of bosons, and bosons tend to condense, form a superfluid. But starting from a superfluid, you can deform the theory by, for example, modifying interactions to change the dispersion of the Goldstone modes, and you can get various other kinds of bosonic liquids, even killing the superfluid order. So for example, you get the Lifshitz theory if you tune to this kind of quadratic partition, or a few other examples. Okay. You can also start from fermions and you just get Fermi liquid, okay, and also non-Fermi liquid if you couple the fermions to gapless excitations. All right, so the dynamics of these theories can get very complicated. Very active subject, but a recent breakthrough by Al Sundgren Santil sort of tell us that we should think about them, at least a useful way to think about this theory is to consider the emergent symmetries at low energy. Okay. So, and also the anomalies. So by now we have kind of understood that the fitting condition can be thought of as a kind of anomaly, the Tufte anomaly between the charge U1 symmetry and the translation symmetries of lattice model. Okay. Since it's anomaly, it has consequences even at low energy. So that's why it's useful to think about it in this way. Okay. And this fitting anomaly, it must be embedded into the Tufte anomaly of the emergent symmetry group of any series that we propose to describe the low energy physics. So what this recent work shows is that arbitrary fitting is actually a very stringent condition. For example, you cannot embed the fitting anomaly for arbitrary fitting anomaly into, say, a compact zero-form symmetry group, or just zero-form, just the usual global symmetry. Okay? Or even if you allow, say, higher-form symmetries, well, if the higher-form symmetry is only finite, it doesn't help. So arbitrary fitting excludes any kinds of compact zero-form symmetry or finite higher group symmetry, higher form symmetry. We can also just go back and look at the two well-known examples of Fermi liquid and superfluid, boson superfluid, from this point of view. So the Fermi liquid has a huge symmetry at low energy because essentially it's in the Landau Fermi liquid, the momentum, the Fermi occupation number on each momentum on the Fermi surface is conserved, at least at low energy. Okay. So that gives you at least roughly an infinite number of U1 symmetries. In the case of superfluid, the low energy theory has, of course, a zero form U1 symmetry, but also a higher form, one form U1 symmetry in two dimensions, and even higher form in higher dimensions. So that sort of goes around this no-go theory. Okay. These are essentially the only two known mechanisms to sort of saturate or realize this fitting anomalies in two dimensions or in higher dimensions. So let's now look at this infinite component transignment theory with a particular choice of the parameter from this point of view. Okay. So let me first quickly review what are the symmetries of a transignment theory. Okay. So, and here I only keep the topological term and will only consider the continuous symmetries. So since we have compact U1 gauge fields, they come with the magnetic U1 symmetries, which whose charges are the magnetic monopoles. So the current of the symmetry is just the Hodge star of field strands. Okay. And we can assemble them into just a single global U1. You can select a single U1 by just weigh these currents by a charge vector T. Okay. Now, this theory also has higher form symmetries, but it usually doesn't have any continuous higher form symmetry unless this K matrix has a zero mode, meaning that you can find a vector such that K times V is zero, so it has a null vector. Okay. When you have a null vector, this transignment theory has a continuous U1 higher form symmetry, just now shifting it by a flat connection times this V of I. Okay. And there is a two-fold anomaly between the charge U1 and also the zero form U1, the one form U1, okay, which you can work out. And coefficient of this anomaly is given by the product of the charge vector and also this zero mode V. Okay, so let's apply this to this infinite component transignment theory. Of course, we'll do it for a finite number of layers and see how things change with a number of layers. Okay. Before that, let me actually discuss a higher form symmetry from the point of view of the lattice model. Okay. So this one form symmetry in the superfluid is physically nothing but the conservation of vorticity. So one form symmetry charge is basically the vorticity in the superfluid. Of course, the vorticity is not conserved. In general, the vortex can have dynamics, but at very low energy, you don't even have any vortices. So the vorticity is zero at low energy. So that's obviously conserved. And having this one-form symmetry means that the vortices are static. And that's also natural from the low energy point of view because they are massive objects. Now, what happens in this coupled wire lattice model? Well, one can sort of think of it as a stack of superfluid, but then coupled by hopping of vortices. The interaction induces hopping of vortices, as I explained in this slide for the lattice interaction. But one can show that the total vorticity for a given region, given two-dimensional region, sum over all layers is conserved. So if you count the vorticity inside this long cylinder, the vorticity is conserved, even though vortices are coming in and out, but the particular pattern of the motion of the vortices conserves vorticity in this very long cylinder. So it's a kind of a mixed higher form symmetry. We call it cylindrical higher form symmetry in the paper. All right, so with all these, now we can go and check whether this Lorentz theory has the right anomaly to realize the fitting, arbitrary fitting condition. Of course, we knew that it worked, you know, because we derived it from the lattice model, but it's good to actually directly see that from the Lorentz point of view. So again, assume that we have a finite number of layers and with periodic boundary condition. The boundary condition does not really change the conclusion. Now, we have two symmetries, you know, to analyze a filling condition. So one is a global charge U1, okay, which is just this T vector for the Trans-Simon theory. And we also have a zero mode or this null vector that describes the charge of the U1 one-form symmetry, which turns out to be exactly the same. Now, this one-form symmetry, this same charge vector, can actually be understood as a magnetic monopole. So, if you just take this charge vector, it describes a magnetic monopole in this infinite component Trans-Simon theory, and this is the only gauge invariant operator at Lorentz. Okay? Any other monopole operator is not gauge invariant. So, it's a very non-local monopole operator. So that's why we don't have to worry about the Polyakov's confinement for this gauge theory. Okay? And we can actually identify this non-local monopole operator with a string order parameter in the weak superfluid. And now one can show that this fitting anomaly is actually embedded right correctly into the mixed anomaly between the two, the zero form and one form symmetry. And the anomaly coefficient is n times z, which is what you expect since we take the limit, we take a kind of a finite number of layers. So if you see it as a two-dimensional system, the fitting factor is n times nu. So the anomaly coefficient does grow with n, and that's kind of reflecting the three-dimensional nature of the system. All right, so I think I'm almost out of time, but let me And briefly describe what happens for the other choice of the parameter. So from this analysis, you can see that whenever you have a zero mode of the K matrix for every size of the system, then this infinite Trans-Simon theory actually describes a weak superfluid. Okay? And this happens, at least for this particular choice of the K matrix, only for essentially three values of the ratio between m and n. So it's either m equals zero or m equals one or m equals two. For all the other choices of m and n, this is not a super weak superfluid and is not compressible. But for these three cases, they are all compressible states. And for the other values of m and n, we have shown that when it's m is greater than 2n, it's actually a kind of fracton phase with planar excitations. Although it has this unusual grading between unusual quasi long range grading. Now, when m is smaller than 2n and it's not one of these three special values, then it represents a stable gapless phase with gapped planar excitations.
Okay. All right. So when you have more than one zero modes, do you worry about potential instability from those guys?
In this kind of theory, because we choose a K matrix to be translation invariant, all the zero modes are translation invariant.
Oh,
so they're all the zero modes are very non-local. They're all like this string, like objects.
But if you have thermodynamically many of them, if you have order L of
you have lots of these modes.
Right, then you can potentially form superposition of those that are localized, right? I mean, they're essentially one year kind of states.
I see. But in most theories that you can write down, you only have a handful of these zero modes.
Oh, I see.
I guess that's probably the otherwise.
Sorry. You have handful of zero modes at kx, ky equal to zero.
Well, they are right. Yeah, they are. So. You can probably say the same thing in the case of one zero mode, right? So it's just that there's a operator, there's a kind of string-like operator, of course, for each position in the XY plane. And it is sort of long-range ordered. You know, if you take the finite number of layers, it has a long-range order, but this value, the saturated value of the two-point function decays with the number of layers.
Okay.
So that's why we still call it superfluid, to acknowledge that fact, but it's a weak one because the order kind of dies away if you take the thermodynamic limit.
All right, thanks.
Great. All right, so for the last couple of minutes, I just want to flesh out that we have also considered other kinds of coupled wire model, which has a different flavor compared to the infinite component transimon series. They're also compressible, but they don't have this string-like order parameter. Rather, there are membrane-like operators which have quasi-long-range order with a scaling dimension that, again, grows with the number of the sites on the intersection. So now, just to mention that. And lastly, I want to just quickly mention that this kind of three-dimensional, there's a different kind of three-dimensional transimons-like theory that was introduced by Levine and Fisher 12 years ago, where you have integer quantum Hall layers coupled to three-dimensional U1 gauge fields with very different low energy dynamics. All right, so I'll just summarize. And thanks all for attention.
All right, thanks, Meng. It was a very interesting talk. Any more questions from the audience? Yeah, go ahead, Darren.
Thank you. Yeah, very, very nice talk. I had a few questions. One question is, would you say that this weak symmetry breaking is sort of like a topological order? I mean,
sorry, can you say again?
This weak symmetry breaking, is it like some kind of topological order in some sense? I know it's a gapless system, so I should not call it topological order, but is there some sense of having some, I don't know, some...
Right. So I think you can probably say that this weak symmetry breaking coexists with
right
sort of topological order, because you do have these non-trivial quasi particles. They have long-range order. They have long-range.
Right.
But okay, there are the non-trivial quasi particles, and there's a ground state degeneracy, which, as far as we can tell, it's also exponentially small splitting.
Right. So if I look at the spectrum, there will be states which are this 1/L modes, but they are e to the power minus L.
I believe so. Yes.
Right. So I think I was trying to ask whether I would think weak symmetry breaking probably cannot exist without any coexistence topological. I think that was my kind of question. Yeah, is that fair to say?
That's a very good point. I was wondering about the same thing. Although could not prove it. But I agree that this weak symmetry breaking probably has to occur in a system with some sort of topological order. And I borrow this name from a paper there's this weak symmetry breaking types appendix. But that's actually a topological order system in the gap system. There's another example of weak symmetry breaking on the boundary between like TI and quantum Hall, that was also in 2D, where you don't have any local order parameter, but some non-local string breaks the symmetry.
Mm-hmm. So in the example by Kitaev, this weak symmetry breaking in his appendix, and he mentions that, is there still, in that case also, is there some non-local order parameter which characterizes it?
I think that example is very different. I think he just gave the example of this Torrey code model,
when you translate model. E becomes M, right?
Yeah. So in some sense, the ground states breaks the symmetry because the different ground states are could be related by symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct, actually? well, I guess you can probably write down an E string along some direction, and if you translate, it becomes an M string. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, you have some kind of weak symmetry breaking.
Right, right.
And all the parameters, not anything local, it's just these long.
Right, lines. Yeah, that's right, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so in that sense, I mean, I'm using this weak symmetry breaking in the same, similar meaning.
Mm-hmm, yes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I had one more question. Can I ask? I don't know whether.
Sure, go
ahead.
On.
Go.
So the question I had was, so when we have superfluid, let's consider like maybe more normal scenario than norm and more conventional kind of superfluid coexisting with some topological order, some kind of SF star phase, then yeah. Vortices have some interesting property that vortices carry momentum, which is not conventional. So if you tread up, if you just do the usual flux treading argument that you tread a flux and ask how much momentum vortex carries, at least when the gauge theory is odd, then there is a extra shift of the momentum, very much like FL star phase where the Y zones, whatever, I mean, carry momentum and so on. And so is there, so if I repeat that flux shredding argument here, because that's like a Luttinger theorem for this gapless phase. So is there some additional term get in addition to what would be in a, basically, I'm asking what's the momentum of the vortex because of the topological order? Is there a shift?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, right, that was like, oops, did I just, it's just the end of it. Maybe let me go back to this slide. All right, so this is a slide where this is a calculation of filling anomaly. Right, so in this case, because it's a continuous filling factor, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, these topological excitations, first of all, it can at most change, maybe I should be a little more careful, but it usually just changes this filling factor by a finite amount, some discrete quantized value. In this case, I should be careful because there are infinite types of topological excitations. But to get this continuous filling factor, it doesn't seem like you actually need to consider these gapped excitations. The gapped excitations are the finite one-form symmetry in the problem. And that filling factor entirely, continuous filling factor entirely comes from the continuous part of the higher form symmetry. I mean, because it's a superfluid, it's a weak superfluid. Right, so we haven't thought very carefully about whether there's a scenario in which the gap excitations also contribute. In this case, it doesn't seem like, at least not for the arbitrary filling. So if you go away from this particular point where you have m equals minus 2n, you look at other values of m and n, where and you don't have this weak superfluid, then in that case, you can still put a theory on some special filling factors, some rational filling factors. And in that case, you suspect that these topological excitations contribute to the filling factor. Mm-hmm.
I see.
And here, because you have a continuous one, so that all these quantized fractions sort of just are hidden, are just kind of washed away.
Thank you.
Actually, I have a question that's probably isomorphic to Tarun's last question. So let's say I take a usual superfluid. When I think about this filling constraint and so on. So one intuitive way is to say, let's say in 2D, that means my vortex, for the vortex, the translations when acting on the vortex do not commute dx, dy.
Yeah.
There's a phase factor. And 3D, okay, it's a little bit complicated, but it's similar.
Right.
So in that language, what are your vortices doing here?
The vortices are is actually a particle in one layer. So you have different right. kinds of vortices in each layer. So right. That's you know, what the vortex looks like. But yeah, I got pretty confused at some point, trying to think about it in this way that you described. I eventually sort of abandoned that and just directly work with higher form symmetry. It turns out that what you need to do, I mean, it's probably easier to describe that way. What happens that the translation symmetry is embedded into the two-form background of the higher form symmetry. And that's how you get this Phelian anomaly.
Is that basically because you have too many different kinds of forces and it's hard to keep track of which one is important and so on?
So I haven't entirely figured out what happens with flux threading, but I would imagine that you might get a whole chain of vortices if you try to insert a flux in that direction.
Right.
One possibility, and then that could explain. Then if this chain of vortices move around, you will get the Phelian factor. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but no, we didn't follow that line of argument. Right. Well, I was reading your paper, trying to figure out how to describe the Phelian anomaly. So eventually, using this formal field theory, response theory, you can kind of describe it. Rather straightforwardly.
All right, any more questions?
Can I ask you a quick question? Sure. So if you Higgs this theory, then the compressibility will be gone, I suppose?
If you Higgs a theory, I believe, usually if you Higgs it, it would become a gap theory,
right?
And
but do you still get like fractal like theory after that?
Oh, you get okay. That's a good point. So right. So let me actually maybe pull out an earlier slide. Right. So So if you hit a theory, you actually get something that looks like this one.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just do the simplest say. Z2 Higgsing each of the layer gauge field, you basically get this theory.
But then what about this non-local braiding properties? Those things remain or those are also gone? Or?
Oh, those will be gone if you Higgs it.
Okay, I see.
Yeah, but once you Higgs it, now it's just some finite gauge fields and mm-hmm. you cannot expect this long range braiding to occur. It have to be finite range.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then one conjecture that if you Higgs it, you'll get this kind of foliated theory, mm-hmm. Although mm-hmm. we cannot prove it.
Right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Maybe I can ask one more question if there are questions.
I'm
good. About your so initially you showed that the gap case that the braiding between different layers decays exponentially, the mod of just e to the power whatever. I mean, so exponentially decaying. So that remains still true, right? It's not like the power law in your case when you have
that's still true. In what?
Like in this gapless case, if I try to define something like that,
Yeah, I didn't say anything about braiding because first you have to make sure that braiding is well defined in these gapless, these vortices, these excitations actually have ranging functions. So it turns out that in this case, at least naively, if you so there's some problem with the vortices. If you try to directly braid the vortices, the interaction decays as 1/√R. R is actually a separation of plane. And the dynamical phase you accumulate in the braiding would be too much. You cannot really make sense. Okay, naively, at least just do this simple counting, you cannot really get the topological piece out. It's going to be,
I see.
It's going to be basically overwhelmed by the dynamical phase. However, for example, for excitations with no vorticity, if you create a dipole, then the interactions gonna have higher power. You cancel out plus minus, so you get a R to say minus 3/2. Then in that case, from a simple counting, the dynamical phase becomes small if you separate the two particles far away. Mm-hmm. And then you can actually make sense of braiding. And in that case, the braiding phase would decay as 1 over the distance, not exponentially.
I see. That's great. I see.
Yeah.
Because initially I was thinking when you mentioned that there was a question, I think by Zhang, that it has to decay exponentially with local theories. At least my naive guess was, if you have a gap, then maybe it's related to the mutual information decaying exponentially.
Right.
And now you have closed the gap, so maybe it can become power law.
Indeed, this is, in this case, it is a power law. Mm-hmm. And in some other theories, actually, I think I should have mentioned it. There's an upcoming paper by Xie and her students that study also some of these theory. I forgot to include the reference. That they show that in some series, the braiding actually doesn't decay at all. It's like, you know, just oscillate in a few values. It's even more strange. In this case, we can go back to lattice model and construct a string operator. The string operator has an algebraic profile in some direction. Mm-hmm. When you try to move it along the x direction, the string actually has to have an algebraic tail. So it's, I'm a bit hesitating to call it actually a local excitation because of the algebraic tail, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, cool, thank you.
Yeah. Sure.
Any more question? All right, if not, let's thank Meng again for this, it was a fun event.
yeah, I enjoyed it. Thank you all for attending.
Thank you.